Thank you very much. It's an honor and a privilege to be back in Iowa, and I want to thank my good friend, your former governor, Tom Vilsack, for that very generous introduction and for his leadership. During his campaign for the presidency, he was one of the strongest voices for a change in the direction in Iraq. And I want to thank Tom and Christy for their friendship and their leadership in my campaign. Today, President Bush will speak once again to the nation about Iraq. Our message to the president is clear. It is time to begin ending this war. Not next year. Not next year, not next month, but today. We have heard for years that as the Iraqis stand up, our troops will stand down. Every year we hear about how next year they may start coming home. Now we are hearing a new version of that very familiar song from the president. He claims that we can, with slight adjustments, stay the course. There are more troops in Iraq today than ever before. The Iraqi government is more fractured and less effective. The right strategy before the surge and the right strategy now, post-escalation, is the same. Start bringing our troops home. America. America needs a president with the strength and experience to end this war. I will be that president. Our brave men and women who wear the uniform of our country deserve nothing less. As a senator and as a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, I have had the privilege of meeting with many veterans in Iraq, here in Iowa, and across America. They represent the very best of our country. When called on, they respond, serving with tremendous courage, dedication, and honor. Many of them from our National Guard and reserves, and many of them not just once, but with multiple tours of duty. Each mission they were given, they completed. They conducted a thorough search for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and found none. They removed Saddam Hussein from power and brought him to justice. They helped the citizens of Iraq organize and hold elections and vote for new leaders. They gave the Iraqi government the space and time to act if they chose to do so. But over the past 4 years, the situation in Iraq has dramatically deteriorated. The mission today is more about policing a civil war than building a democracy. Our troops now serve alongside Iraqi army officers and soldiers. Some have their loyalty to Iraq. Others, however, are loyal to the sectarian militias. Some have served bravely alongside our soldiers. Others have looked the other way when the insurgents have planted bombs. Some even have taken up arms against Americans. Our troops are paying the price. 3,598 have lost their lives, 43 from right here in Iowa. These past 3 months have been the deadliest quarter on record, with 331 fatalities. One Army chaplain told a reporter that he tries to read a unique passage from Scripture over the body of each soldier who has been killed in his unit. But the casualties have been so heavy, he has nearly run out of suitable verses. Then there are the wounded, more than 26,000 so far. Many hurt so badly, they will never fully recover. Many more with invisible wounds, depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, traumatic brain injury. young people in the prime of their lives, unable to work, struggling to relate to their families and reintegrate into their communities. Many are not getting the treatment they need. Some have turned to drugs and alcohol. A few have even taken their own lives. Then there are the families who pay their own price for this war, struggling to raise children alone, trying to find the right answers to all the questions about when mom or dad is coming home. Some forced to explain that mom or dad is never coming home. Our troops' sacrifice is their sacrifice, too. Then there is the price the Iraqis have paid. Tens of thousands of civilians and several thousand members of the Iraqi security forces have been killed. Millions of Iraqis have fled their homes, nearly 100,000 a month, under threat of execution by sectarian militias and kidnappings by criminal gangs. Then there are the financial costs. More than $450 billion so far. At the current rate of spending, we could provide access to high-quality pre-kindergarten for every four-year-old in America, extend health care to all 45 million Americans who are currently uninsured, and make college affordable for more than 1 million students. Then there is our work in Afghanistan, yet another casualty of the war in Iraq. When I first visited there in 2003, I was greeted by a soldier who said, "Welcome to the forgotten front lines in the war against terror." Distracted by Iraq, we have squandered much of what our military accomplished in Afghanistan, eroded our position among the Afghan people, limited the potential of President Karzai's moderate government, and failed to stem the renewed aggression by the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. For while the Bush administration has neglected Afghanistan, the terrorists and drug traffickers have not. A recent UN report found that Afghanistan's production of opium, the raw material for heroin, increased nearly 50% last year to a total that was more than 90% of the world's illicit opium production in 2006. The heroin trade finances the very Taliban fighters and Al-Qaeda terrorists who are attacking our troops and gaining new footholds in parts of Afghanistan. The catalog of miscalculations, misjudgments, and mistakes in Iraq shocks the conscience. From the unilateral decision to rush into a preemptive war without allowing the inspectors to finish their work or waiting for diplomacy to run its course, to the failure to send enough troops or provide proper equipment for them, to the denial of a rising insurgency and the failure to adjust the military strategy, to continued support for a government unwilling to make the necessary political compromises, and to the adherence to a broken policy more than 4 years after the invasion began. As a result of these failures, the next president will inherit some of the greatest foreign policy challenges in our history: rising terrorism and extremism, frayed alliances, and the increasingly difficult task of restoring American leadership in a world that has come to view our nation with suspicion and mistrust. We cannot effectively address any of these challenges if we continue our current military engagement in Iraq. As long as we stay there, our military strength will continue to erode, our standing in the world will continue to decline, our enemies in the region will continue to exploit our failures, our occupation will continue to serve as a recruitment tool for terrorists, our support for Afghan democracy, our conflict with the Taliban, our hunt for Al-Qaeda will continue to be compromised, and our brave men and women will continue to lose their lives and suffer grievous wounds. Finally, some of the respected members of the president's own party in the Senate are beginning to acknowledge these realities. Senator Lugar, ranking member of the Foreign Relations Committee and a leading voice on foreign affairs for decades, stated his opposition to staying the course in Iraq. Senators Voinovich and most recently Senator Domenici have also called on President Bush to change course. After more than 4 years and nearly half a trillion dollars and human costs beyond measure, it is abundantly clear there is no military solution to the crisis in Iraq. It is long past time. It is long past time that the President ended American combat involvement in Iraq's multi-sided sectarian civil war, fought for power, revenge, and personal advantage. That is what I have been trying to do in the Senate, actively calling for and consistently voting for phased redeployment of our troops out of Iraq. That is why I voted against a bill to fund the war without any plan for ending it. That is why I've introduced legislation to begin bringing our troops home in 90 days. And that's why I'm joining other Democrats to add provisions to the Defense Authorization Bill, which we are debating in the Senate this week, that would force the President to change course in Iraq. Among those provisions is legislation I am sponsoring with Senator Robert Byrd to deauthorize the war, legislation that would actually end the President's authority to fight it. I hope and pray that a bipartisan majority of the Congress will be able to persuade or force the President to change course. In September, General David Petraeus, the commanding general in charge of Iraq, will issue a report on the progress of the surge. If the past is any guide, the President will most likely decide to maintain his failed strategy, regardless of what the report says, just as he rejected the thoughtful recommendations of the bipartisan Iraq Study Group. If that happens, if the President refuses to end this war before he leaves office, when I'm President, I will quickly, responsibly, and in a way that will restore, not weaken, America's leadership in the world. This will be my first and most important mission as President, one I believe I have the strength and experience to complete. Today, I want to lay out my three-point plan for how I would achieve this, how as President I would bring our troops home, work to bring stability to the region, and replace a military force with a new diplomatic initiative to engage countries around the world in securing Iraq's future and America's national security interests. The most important part of my plan is the first step, end our military engagement in Iraq's civil war and immediately start bringing our troops home as quickly and carefully as possible. No permanent occupation of the country, no more neighborhood patrols, no more being caught in the middle of a war whose side we do not even know we should be on. At the end of the day, the Iraqis are responsible for Iraq's future. And if we have learned anything these past 4 years, it is that we cannot successfully police a civil war. Therefore, keeping our troops in the crossfire of sectarian violence is not the answer. Bringing them home swiftly and responsibly is. As President, I will convene the Joint Chiefs of Staff, my Secretary of Defense, and my National Security Council, and direct them to draw up a clear, viable plan to bring our troops home starting within the first 60 days of my administration. We should do this as quickly as we can, consistent with preserving our security and protecting our troops. I have been long worried that the Pentagon is not adequately planning for the withdrawal of our troops because the White House does not want them to plan for withdrawal. I have written to the Secretary of Defense as well as to the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and asked them to please let us know in Congress what plans they have. Withdrawing troops is dangerous and difficult, especially when we will have to convoy our troops and their equipment out of Iraq along the very same roads that are booby-trapped with explosive devices. It requires enormous care and precision, and I hope that we will start that process before I am president. We should redeploy our troops steadily and consistently, not in fits and starts. And as we bring our troops home, we must ensure that we are fully prepared to care for them and their families once they have returned. So as the Joint Chiefs... So as the Joint Chiefs and Secretary of Defense are drawing up a redeployment plan, I will direct the Department of Defense and the Department of Veterans Affairs to prepare a comprehensive plan to provide the highest quality health care, disability benefits, and social services for every single service member, including every member of the National Guard and Reserve. And I will make sure this plan is promptly funded and implemented. Today, we are not providing the care our veterans deserve. We have all heard the heartbreaking stories about soldiers languishing in filthy, decrepit facilities. The facilities at Walter Reed were a disgrace, and our president recently referred to them, and I quote, as some bureaucratic red tape issues. But sadly, that is not the case. The Walter Reed scandal is just the tip of a nasty iceberg. Veterans across America struggling with traumatic brain injury and other wounds are told to take a number and wait in line for months. Veterans trying to get their disability pay are running into a wall of indifference from their own government. Military families trying to get the life insurance benefits they are entitled to are drowning in delay and rejection. When our young men and women put on our country's uniform, when they go into harm's way for our American family, they are our sons and daughters, and it is past time that we started treating them as they were a member of our family. That's what I have tried to do in the Senate by expanding health care for our National Guard and Reserve members, sponsoring legislation to increase military survivor benefits from $12,000 to $100,000, authoring the Heroes at Home legislation to help service members and their families deal with post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury. As president, I'll propose guaranteed funding for our VA health care system and a GI Bill of Rights for the 21st century, to help veterans buy their own homes, build their own businesses, attend college, and get the training they need for good, high-paying jobs. The second part of my plan... The second part of my plan involves working to secure stability within Iraq as we bring our troops home. Right now, the Iraqi government is failing its citizens. Government officials refuse to take the steps needed to advance a political solution, improve the economy, and better the lives of ordinary Iraqis. They refuse to do their part to quell sectarian violence, and some even participate in it. As president, I will focus American aid efforts during our redeployment on stabilizing Iraq, not propping up the Iraqi government. Financial resources will only go where they can be used properly. We will no longer funnel money to those government ministries and ministers that hoard it, steal it, or waste it. If by the time I take office, Iraq's central government has proven that it is committed to rebuilding the country and striving for sustainable stability and political reconciliation, we'll send aid to that government. If not, we'll consider providing aid to provincial governments and reliable non-governmental organizations that are making progress. I will also urge the appointment of a high-level United Nations representative, similar to those appointed in Afghanistan, Bosnia, and Kosovo, to help broker peace among the parties in Iraq. This representative will press the Iraqis to achieve defined political objectives, to help them build a stake in their country, including, most importantly, the equitable distribution of oil revenues among the regions in Iraq, so everyone gets a fair share and ordinary Iraqis start feeling like they have a stake in the country's future. I have promoted the idea of an oil trust for more than 3 years because I believe it would help convince Iraqis that they will benefit from a stable Iraq more than the continuing sectarian conflict. I tried to convince the Bush administration to adopt this idea, which we did in Alaska. When Alaska was discovered to have oil, every Alaskan gets a check. So every Alaskan has a stake in making sure that the pipeline is safe and that the process continues. And I believed it would have made such a difference immediately if the United States, when we were still the occupying power, had created such an oil trust. I'm told that my idea... I'm told that my idea, which did have Republican support, got as far as the Vice President's office, where a lot of good ideas apparently die in Washington. Third, as we redeploy our troops, we will replace our military force in Iraq with an intensive diplomatic initiative in the region. To bring about long-term stability in Iraq and prevent violence and unrest from spilling over into other parts of the area, one of the most dangerous parts of the world to begin with. This will be a first step toward restoring America's moral and strategic leadership in the world, one that draws on the strength of our alliances and the power of our diplomacy, and uses military force as a last, not a first, resort. Over the past 4 years, we have learned the hard way about the need for a truly multilateral approach in Iraq, one built on sound strategy and long-range planning, not ideology and wishful thinking. The President's go-it-alone attitude has diminished our position in the region and around the world, and our diminished position, in turn, has made it increasingly difficult for us to bring about a political solution in Iraq. Our relationship with Turkey is just one example. 6 years ago, at the end of the Clinton administration, support for the United States in Turkey, a longtime ally in NATO, stood at over 50%. Today, according to a recent Pew study, it's at just 9%. This is the most spectacular deterioration of relations with a treaty ally in memory. So we've dug ourselves into a pretty deep hole, haven't we? But I am confident we can dig ourselves out. I believe we can return to a foreign policy in which, as my friend, former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright once said, we cooperate with others whenever we can and act alone only when we have to, not the other way around. I believe we can restore our standing in the world and begin to restore stability in Iraq by restoring our use of meaningful diplomacy in the region. That starts with drawing our troops down and drawing upon the international community to make a commitment to Iraq's future. So in my first days in office, I'll begin work to convene a regional stabilization group composed of key allies, other global powers, and all of the states bordering Iraq. The mission of this group will be to develop and implement a strategy to create a stable Iraq. Working with the United Nations representative, the group will first work to convince Iran, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Syria to refrain from getting involved in the civil war, either directly or indirectly by backing local militants and militias. None of these countries benefits if Iraq implodes and the resulting chaos spills over the borders. Although I believe American military disengagement will reduce the likelihood of regional interference in Iraq's internal affairs over the long run, I acknowledge that in the short run, there may well be increased violence and instability following our troop withdrawals. In Bosnia, before the U.S.-led NATO actions resulted in the Dayton Peace Accords, the sectarian violence claimed 200,000 lives and created 2 million refugees, and Iraq has 6 times as many people. So unless the leaders of the various insurgent groups and militias and the government change course, Iraq could reach the per capita Bosnian casualty rates, claiming hundreds of thousands more Iraqi lives and causing millions more to flee. This tragic possibility, however, does not justify continuing our failed policy, but it does intensify the importance of the other elements of my plan. The UN-led group will attempt to mediate among the different sectarian groups in Iraq with the goal of attaining compromises on fundamental issues like the structure of their government, the contours of their economic policy, and a system for dividing oil revenues. This will no doubt be difficult. But achieving agreement on issues like these is a critical step for building a stable future in Iraq. The members of the group will hold themselves and other countries to their past pledges to provide funding to Iraq, and they'll encourage additional contributions to meet Iraq's extensive needs. As it stands now, the United States is shouldering far too great a share of the financial burden for rebuilding Iraq. As of February 2007, foreign donors had made good on only about $4 billion of the $15 billion in pledges from the Madrid conference. Some wealthy Gulf nations have come up especially short. Countries around the world have a stake in Iraq's future, and they should also contribute to securing it. Let me say a word about the place of Iran and Syria in this new diplomatic initiative. There is no question that these two regimes are among the most difficult and dangerous in the world. They pose direct threats to their neighbors, to Israel, our strategic ally and friend, and far beyond the region. Iran's president has hosted a conference devoted to denying the Holocaust, placing him in company with the most despicable bigots and historical revisionists, and both countries sponsor terrorism directly and indirectly through Hezbollah and Hamas. Unfortunately, for most of the past 6 years, President Bush has adopted a simple and fundamentally flawed strategy for dealing with these countries. We don't talk to bad people. Now, I think you agree with me that we strongly disagree with this approach. Even during the Cold War, we never stopped talking to the Soviet Union. Even when they had thousands of missiles pointed at us, even when their leaders threatened to bury us, even when they were invading countries and inciting military uprisings around the world, that was the smart policy, one embraced by both Democratic and Republican presidents. We know this approach can be effective now, as it was back then. Look what happened when the administration, after 6 years of neglect, during which North Korea built up its nuclear program, finally pursued aggressive face-to-face talks with North Korea. We got them to agree to suspend their nuclear weapons program, and we didn't have to sacrifice a single American life to achieve that goal. We ended the genocide and ethnic cleansing in the Balkans without sacrificing a single American life. The administration should learn from the progress made in North Korea and take a similar approach toward Iran and Syria. While they did meet recently with Iranian officials, they now appear reluctant to continue that effort. When I am president, we will deal with Syria and Iran right from the beginning. We will engage them in open, frank, tough-minded discussions about the status of Iraq, and we will convey our strong bipartisan position that Iran cannot be allowed to obtain nuclear weapons. Now, let me be clear. Engagement does not mean a warm embrace. I have no illusions about Iran and Syria, but we must also be realistic. Diplomacy is difficult and time-consuming. It is frustrating at times, and it may not bear fruit, but it is the best tool we have given the challenges we face. As we are leaving Iraq, and after we have left, we need to engage the world in a global humanitarian effort to confront the human costs created by this war. That is the final component of our diplomatic initiative. Since the start of the war, 2 million Iraqis have fled their country, mainly to Jordan and Syria, and 2 million more have been displaced from their homes and neighborhoods within Iraq. Many are living in desperate conditions, creating not just a humanitarian crisis, but one with strategic security consequences for the region. That could become a direct threat to us. As president, I will organize a multi-billion-dollar international effort funded by a wide range of donor states under the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. Through this initiative, the Commissioner for Refugees will direct aid to build infrastructure and create a social safety net in Jordan, Syria, and other countries that have taken in refugees. This money will go to schools, hospitals, and housing, along with initiatives to create jobs and promote economic development. At the same time, the Commissioner for Refugees will be empowered to address the needs of Iraqis who have been displaced from their homes by the violence but remain inside their country. These efforts will confront the challenges posed by large-scale refugee camps in Jordan, which could destabilize that country and the region. For what we spend in just 1 month on this war, $8 billion plus, the world can fund this refugee initiative for an entire year and then some. These funds should help ensure a long-term solution, one that addresses the fundamental needs of refugees, rather than resorting to the limited and often counterproductive solution of refugee camps. I stress that because we have to be very careful not to create cauldrons of distress and outrage by putting people into these refugee camps and then leaving them there. And I will try everything I can to avoid that. While we will focus our efforts on improving conditions so that Iraqis don't have to flee in the first place, we will also recognize our moral obligation to help those we have put at risk in Iraq, the interpreters, the soldiers, and the workers who have assisted our troops. I have been to Iraq 3 times. I have met these brave people who cast their lot with America. Many of them have been assassinated, members of their families as well. I believe we owe an obligation, particularly to them. So, as part of this global humanitarian effort, governments in both the Middle East and the West, as well as here in the United States, will have to take in asylum seekers, with the High Commissioner for Refugees developing a plan to help them return to Iraq once the country has stabilized. Engaging in this humanitarian effort will not require continued military involvement on our part. Just the opposite, in fact. We need to redeploy our troops out of Iraq before we can undertake this diplomatic initiative with any hope for success. Finally, as we do bring our troops home, we cannot lose sight of our very real strategic national interests in the region. If in the future Iraq becomes a breeding ground for exporting terrorists, as it appears it already is, as we are learning about those who planned and tried to carry out the attacks in London, that is a great worry for our country. So as we redeploy our troops from Iraq, I will not let down my guard against terrorism. I will devote the resources we need to fight it and fight it smartly. I will order specialized units to engage in narrow and targeted operations against Al-Qaeda and other terrorist organizations in the region. They will also provide security for U.S. troops and personnel and train and equip Iraqi security services to help keep order only to the extent we believe such training is actually working. I would also consider, as I have said before, leaving some forces in the Kurdish area to protect the fragile but real democracy and relative peace and security that has developed there. And as president, I will work to ensure a stable and peaceful relationship between Turkey and the Kurds in northern Iraq, both of whom are our friends and allies. We must not permit a conflict between these two allies to become another consequence of the Iraq War. Our regional efforts must also involve a recommitment to success in Afghanistan. The Taliban is resurging. They and their al-Qaeda allies must not succeed. As president, I will not allow us to fail in Afghanistan. We simply... cannot allow al-Qaeda to reclaim the country as its safe haven or the Taliban to reestablish its repressive regime. Now, will any of this be easy? Of course not. It's going to take tremendous discipline, patience, and hard work. But I believe it can be done. We can be a lot smarter about getting out of this war than we were about getting into it. And the future of our national security and international standing depends upon it. And we owe our troops and their families nothing less. I want to end by telling you about one of those service members, a chief warrant officer in the Iowa Army National Guard named Bruce Smith from West Liberty, Iowa. My friend Tom Vilsack told me about Bruce Smith and his courageous wife, Oliva. Bruce was deployed to Iraq. In November 2003, the Chinook helicopter he was piloting was shot down near Fallujah. Bruce had to make a split-second decision about how to maneuver the helicopter. One choice would possibly save his life. The other would possibly save his crewmates. Bruce chose to save his crew. And while he and his co-pilot were killed, 17 members of his crew survived. His wife, Oliva, has said that in those few seconds, those 17 men needed Bruce more than she and her children would need him for the rest of their lives. Bruce Smith made his choice. He chose to be there for his soldiers. It's the choice that so many of our brave men and women in uniform make for each other and for our country every single day. Now it's time we made the same choice for them. It's time we honored their service by bringing them home. And if you give me the chance to serve as your president, that will be my first and highest priority. Thank you, and God bless you.